Good morning, everyone. We'd like you to please settle in here. I'd like to welcome you to this very important Central Coast Project Regional Stakeholder Group meeting. As I think everyone knows, a great deal of work has taken place since the October meeting. There have been no less than 6 work team meetings and a rather huge amount of iTeam staff work that's gone on night and day and through the weekends over the last 5 weeks. I think arriving at a pretty exciting place. What we would like to do in this meeting is really start shifting the focus now to looking not at individual MPA concepts, but looking at candidate packages of MPAs. So let's take a scan of the objectives for this meeting. We'll then go around the table and do introductions and then take a look at the meeting's agenda. What we would like to do is to present and discuss initial candidate MPA packages, and we have several that are teed up for this day. Following that, we want to provide RSG members with opportunities to caucus both within and across interest group arrangements to discuss perhaps revisions to the existing packages of MPAs and also to create the opportunity for inventing new packages of candidate MPAs. And we expect to begin that later this afternoon through the evening and well into tomorrow. We also want to take stock of the relative level of support for the evolving packages and then outline your presentation to the Blue Ribbon Task Force on candidate MPA packages as well as next steps for the December meeting. Just by way of introduction, I want to say that as we noted already, a lot of progress has been made. Today and tomorrow are not the last words in development of these candidate MPA packages. That process will continue between the end of this meeting and the December meeting and really culminate in December. So please bear in mind that we have basically 2 full meetings in the intervening time to finish up this work. And from all appearances, we're in pretty good shape here. Let's go around the table with introductions. I'm Scott McCreary with Concur.
Mike DeLappa with the Initiative.
Marla Morrissey with the Marine Interest Group.
Eric Endersby, RFA Diving.
David Crabb, Commercial Fishermen, Wet Fish Producers Association.
Gordon Hensley, San Luis Obispo Coast Keeper.
Mike Ricketts, Monterey Commercial Fishermen. That's
it. Phil Eisenberg, head of the task force.
John Curlin, Initiative staff.
Michelle Knight, Adventures by the Sea.
Deanne Albers, Friends of the Sea Otter.
Dave Edlin, Recreational Spearfishing.
Steve Berger, Science Advisory Team.
Steve Scheiblauer, the City of Monterey and the California Harbor Masters Association.
Trudy O'Brien, Morro Bay Commercial Fishermen's Organization.
Rick Algert, City of Morro Bay Harbor Director.
Daniel Davis, Marine Technologist in Barre.
Neil Guglielmo, commercial fisherman and a member of the California Wet Fish Producers Association.
John Ugaretz, Department of Fish and Game.
Bill Ward, Port San Luis Commercial Fishermen's Association.
Rick Starr, Science Advisory Team.
Tom Hafer, commercial fisherman, Morro Bay.
Tom Matouche, Shuley Cat Sport Fishing and Coastside Fishing Club.
Ellen Farrow Daniels, California Coastal Commission.
Paul Riley, Department of Fish and Game.
Mark Chargell, scuba diver and marine life photographer.
Robin Robinson, artist and at-large.
Caitlin Gaffney, Ocean Conservancy Conservation.
Bob Hather, Central Coast Fisheries Conservation Coalition.
Howard Egan, Recreational Fishing Alliance.
Chris Lindstrom, Water Quality Consultant.
Jesus Reese, Non-Consumptive Diving.
Art CV, Monterey Abalone Company.
Don Canestro, University of California's Ken Norris Rancho Marino Reserve.
Ray Fields with the Abalone Farm, representing kelp harvesters.
Darby Neal, Virgin Sport Fishing in Morro Bay.
Mary Gleason, Initiative staff.
Paula Serpa, Department of Fish and Game staff.
Holly Price, Monterey Bay Sanctuary.
Eric Ponsley, Concur. And Reed, if we could go around the side, please.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Oh, sorry. Hold on a second.
Let me just share.
There you go.
Rita Bunzel, MLPA staff.
Evan Fox, MLPA staff.
Amy Boone, MLPA staff.
Mike Mertens, ECO Trust.
Chris Ball, MLPA staff.
Don Mariska, Strategic Planning Consultant for the MLPA staff.
Kirk Sturm, MLPA staff.
George Gross, Department of Fish and Game.
Melissa Miller-Henson, MLPA.
Tony Warrington, Department of Fish and Game. Eric Russell, Aquatic Protection Agency, alternate for Chris Lindstrom, Water Quality.
Bob Humphrey, SimCal Divers, Consumptive.
Steve Schimmick, The Otter Project.
Jim Webb, Cambria Fishing Club.
Tom Moylan, Cal Poly State University, alternate for Don Canestro.
Aaron Simmons, The Ocean Conservancy.
John Wolf, Reef Environmental Education Foundation.
Roger Cullen, Morro Bay Commercial Fisherman.
Annie Sartor, Oceana.
Jeff Chester, Oceana.
Will McClintock, UC Santa Barbara.
Carissa Klein, graduate student. Donna Robot, graduate student. Christina Cairns, recent graduated grad student and interested public observer.
Tim Marisich, commercial fisherman, Moss Landing.
Ernie Kep, Alliance of Communities for Sustainable Fisheries.
Thank you, John Wolf.
Elizabeth Bettenhausen, retired prof of Economic Political Ethics.
Karen Garrison, Natural Resources Defense Council.
Great. Thank you all very much. Jesus, did you not introduce?
I have a point of procedure. It's my understanding that Ron Massengill is absent today due to medical issues. And I understand also that he suggested or requested that Jim Webb, who is also a member of his fishing club, the Cambrian Fishing Club, be allowed to be his alternate today, even though technically he's an alternate for another stakeholder. Is that something that the staff and the mediators have considered, and is that something that we may allow if these other stakeholders have no objection?
We did discuss it. Mike DeLappa, can you recall and as to where we concluded on that?
We concluded that it was something the stakeholders could certainly consider if they wanted to. We didn't want to introduce it into the proceedings because we felt we had a full agenda and didn't want to distract people at the end. But, you know, it certainly could be introduced.
Is there some way that the mediators can just ask if there's any objection to it, and if not, and then move forward with it? Okay.
Why, yes, there is. Who would not support seating Jim Webb in the stead of Ron Massengill? Put your card up. Okay. I would like to just note that we did attempt to lay out very specific ground rules with respect to participation, and I believe our answer was the alternates are designated alternates. If they cannot attend, that's pretty much the story. And that's what we concluded. So, Jesus, I appreciate that you brought up the possibility, but I do see a number of your colleagues who prefer to stick with the adopted ground rules. So I would respectfully suggest that we go ahead without Ron, and certainly if Jim has contributions to make, we would invite him to do that through others seated at the table. Thank you very much. Let's look at the agenda review. What we'd like to do is begin with some updates and briefings, not the least of which is an update from John Ugaritz on groundfish. There are a number of other updates that we want to share with you that are tied to some of the handouts and preparatory materials for this discussion, and we have a series of brief updates that will begin in just a moment and then continue to about 11 a.m. At that point, Eric and I will walk through the process approach for presenting, discussing, and evaluating candidate MPA packages. We have a series of presentations that are organized. Don Canestro is going to begin with a presentation on the initial draft concept. That will be at about 11:20. We have public comments scheduled for noon. At 12:20, we have a presentation by Dr. Steve Gaines on ecological networks of marine protected areas, which we think has a perhaps direct bearing on the work that you are to do over the next two meetings. We'll then continue with the presentation of candidate MPA packages. Steve Scheiblauer has a presentation that we have scheduled for about 1:20. We'll take a break at 2:50. We then have a presentation from Caitlin Gaffney and a following presentation from Jesus Ruiz and Mark Chargel. After each of these presentations, we're going to pause. We're going to create opportunities for people to pose questions, to offer observations, to put forward concerns, and perhaps suggestions for potential revisions of these packages. And we anticipate that these presentations and discussions will be very useful grist for your consideration as you go into the late afternoon and evening caucuses. Again, we stress that these presentations of candidate packages are not the last word, but they're certainly a very good way of starting off a conversation to look at the study region in a more comprehensive manner. We do expect that at 5 o'clock we'll be in a caucusing mode. We'll ask the whole plenary group to reflect and take stock on what you've heard, and then we'll try to consider whether there would be interest in developing potential new packages based upon those that you've heard about. And that's something that we'll ask you to bear in mind in a question that we will be posing at 5 o'clock. There is no formal group dinner event that's planned. Group dinner is planned for eating at the Black Hat Bistro. There is no presentation. And the Black Hat Bistro is organized in such a way that there are several different rooms, so people can choose to organize themselves in different ways and continue the conversations and caucusing. Continuing to tomorrow morning, we expect that about the first 2 hours of time, from 8 to 10, will be put aside for additional caucusing for development of new packages. And more particularly, what we expect is that there will be a workstation dedicated here in the main plenary room, really dedicated toward developing potential new packages. There will also be workstations in other breakout sessions dedicated to revising the existing packages that you'll be hearing about later today. We really want to continue to do as we have over the last 2 weeks, and that is to work as an I-team to support development of these packages. We'll take a break at about 10 a.m. We'll then reconvene here in plenary and invite the presentation of any new or revised candidate packages that would have emerged from this activity, from these work groups. We'll then have lunch at 11:45, and we'll continue the presentation and discussion of the revised packages in the first part of tomorrow afternoon. We'll take a fairly good-sized break at 2 o'clock, about a 30-minute break, and at that time, the I-team staff will meet and caucus amongst ourselves. We will compose a straw ballot, which will be intended to take stock of the evolving support for the evolving packages, and we will structure that in that block of time. We'll go ahead and carry out the straw vote in the afternoon at about 2:30, and then we'll discuss how best to present the current state of thinking of the regional stakeholder group to the Blue Ribbon Task Force when it meets at the end of November. We'll also plan next steps that may need to take place between the November meeting and the December meeting. So globally, what we've created here is an opportunity for presentation and discussion of these packages, lots of time for caucusing, and a strong measure of I-team support for revision and invention of new packages. That is the flow of the agenda. With that, I'd like to begin our series of updates and briefings, and we'll turn first to John Ugaretz. Looks like we have a couple of questions. Steve.
Just a clarification about what we all mean, or you mean, by packages. And I think the Act requires that we bring forth network proposals. And so since we do have some, at least at this point in time, some proposals that are not complete networks, how are we going to consider those packages, or are we looking for complete packages, if you will?
Well, our use of the word packages means preliminary concept proposals that address the entire study region. So one or two MPAs does not constitute a package. We're really looking for a study region-wide approach, and that was the test, if you will, that the I-team used to define packages to be presented. Okay? With that, John Ugaretz has an update on groundfish hotspots.
And if somebody can act as my slide clicker for me. We've come to you a couple times now. At the last meeting, Deb Wilson-Vandenberg came and discussed the groundfish hotspot process that the department is undertaking to help with council management. And we wanted to give you an update on that, in particular to show you some of the maps that have been created to help determine the hotspots for canary rockfish. These are still draft and will be presented to the Pacific Fishery Management Council as a potential part of their management process. And next slide. And just the caution, this is draft.
And we
won't be handing it out on paper because of that, but it may be used to assist in decision-making, but you shouldn't rely on this solely. You've got a lot of other resources as well as your own personal knowledge, so this is not the end-all be-all. Next slide. What you see here in a few slides will be showing the overall view of the Central Coast region. And though it's a little hard to see at this scale, we're going to zoom in a minute, but the bars reaching up out of those blocks are in darker blue actual canary rockfish catch and in lighter blue inferred catch based on species that inhabit the same sorts of habitats. And then this is overlaid on top of effort, which is in the white, yellow, and red colors, red being the highest effort and white being the lowest. So essentially what you can do is look at, based on both effort and catch, what areas had the most canary rockfish. Next slide. Just moving down the coast here, you can see that there are areas that have both less effort and catch. And next slide. And then moving further down the region in the last slide, all the way down to Point Conception. So what I want to do is focus in on a particular area so you get a feel of how you might use these data in your deliberations today and tomorrow, and we will provide the data to all of the staff computers so you'll be able to zoom in and out and see these more clearly. But if you look at the next slide, what we've done here is shown three blocks in the Monterey Peninsula area, all of which are right about the 30-fathom line. That's that blue line in the water. And you see that the highest block there, the one straight up on the arrow, has very low canary rockfish catch, both inferred and direct. The middle one to the left has a somewhat moderate level of canary rockfish catch, and the bottom one has a very high level of canary rockfish catch. I chose these blocks because they show different levels of catch and they're at the same depth range. But what you want to do is say, well, are those areas the same level of effort? In other words, is that bottom block just where all of the fishing effort occurred? So if you look at the next slide and overlay effort, you see that all three of these blocks had a relatively high level of effort, and yet they have differing levels of catch. And so what you might infer from this is that you are more likely to catch canary rockfish in that bottom block than in the other two, and in the middle one being a moderate level. And so you could do this for any of the 1 square mile blocks in the region, looking at both effort and catch, and comparing depth ranges and things like that. Of course, the result of this being that if you're considering an MPA in the area and you want to help coordinate with rockfish management, in particular canary rockfish, which is one of the biggest species of concern in this region, that you may want to consider these areas where potential to catch canary rockfish is very high, given that you would then hopefully be benefiting both the fisheries management as well as, for instance, if you're searching to incorporate a specific habitat. So it's available. We've got it to give to all of the technicians here today, and you'll be able to discuss this. Again, it's one piece of information that'll help you in your efforts. And that's all I wanted to present, and I'm happy to take some questions. I see Dave's got his card up.
Yeah, we have time for maybe two or three questions. Dave, go ahead.
John, I just had a question about what depth you're seeing canaries in here. I dive this area a lot. What depth is the shallowest you'd find them in here?
Surprisingly shallow. I mean, obviously, they're in general a shelf species, but they really do get into the shallow water, and we've even made some cases on canary catch in shallow water. These blocks here are all at 30 fathoms. Within that range, 30 fathoms is sort of the center of the block.
I just like to share, I dive this area all the time, and as far as mature canaries, and I think I know what a mature canary looks like, I've never seen one in here in 80 feet or less, and some of those areas I consider my home. I'm sure they do get there occasionally, but I think what you're going to find is that canaries are primarily not right up against shore here, and I think they're going to be skewed towards the deeper part of that 30-fathom line.
And that's a good point. If you look at the way the blocks are arranged, obviously they span, they're about a 1 minute by 1 minute block, so almost one nautical mile square. And what you're seeing there is the catch for that whole block. What you don't know is, did all of that catch occur in the far offshore corner of the block or the far near shore corner or somewhere in between? And so Dave's point is very valid that what you need to overlay this with is your personal knowledge and your knowledge of the species to help apportion that within the block.
And I just make one other comment. We've had dives here where we had fish and game biologists, Dave Ventresca, Paul Riley, and I do not believe we've ever had a canary measured. If it was a real rare occasion. So you're talking some of the deepest free divers, you know, in the United States here. We're diving, you know, Bob Humphrey here, really deep, and we're not catching them. So.
And I sincerely doubt any of them are diving to 30 fathoms. That said, again, remember that the blue bars on this are actual canary catch. So canary catch did occur in those blocks. That's not some made-up number. The lighter blue bars are the inferred catch based on other species. And again, that's why I chose these ones as examples, because as you see, that top one has almost no catch, middle one has a moderate level, and the bottom one has a fairly high level of actual canary catch. So you do need to use your personal knowledge, because it's clear that where that bottom block touches the coast is very unlikely that the catch occurred. But a mile offshore, it's very likely that that is where the catch occurred.
Thanks. Just a general comment about this series of updates. A few of them may provoke a few questions. In general, we're going to ask you to take them offline, because we really want to get to obviously the main event here is the packages. Tom? Bob, sorry.
I was just interested in what the time frame was that was used for this study, because we find that at different times we catch different species of fish in certain areas, and it may have some relevance if this was a study that was done over a long period of time or just a very short period of time.
Right, and it's several years of data. I think it's 98 to 2001 that was used for this. So it's several years of recreational data.
Good. Thanks, Bob. So turning now to some of the other updates, we wanted to briefly touch upon the updated evaluation. Well, actually, first, let's look at the summaries of interim work sessions. Mike DeLappa, you were going to comment briefly on that set of summaries.
Actually, I'm going to cover three updates very quickly. One are the work session summaries. Those are really notes that we prepared out of the six different work sessions to bring people up to speed on if they didn't attend those sessions, what was accomplished. If they did attend those sessions, just to sort of summarize what we heard. Just really, they're a reference for you as we go through deliberations to refer back. There was quite a bit of progress made at those, and we thought it would be helpful not to try and kind of reinvent things. So if everybody could take a look at those, that would be great. Another update, just quickly, there were a couple questions that we forwarded to the science advisory team. One was whether the term marine reserve implies restrictions other than prohibiting extractive uses. We have a memo in your collection, your attachments, that discusses that. Another is whether the Pismo clam should be on the list of species likely to benefit. Again, we have a response from the science advisory team on that, and would be happy to address either of those questions or anything else offline. If you have any further questions or would like additional information about those. Thanks.
Thanks, Mike. We'd like to turn next to hear from Mary Gleason on an updated evaluation of existing Central Coast MPAs. And recall this is something we touched upon at the last meeting. So,
okay.
Mary.
Thanks. And again, I'll just make this quite quick. Attachment 2 is a revised version of the evaluation of existing MPAs and the habitat gap analysis. We did get comments from, I'd say, about a half a dozen stakeholder members and a couple SAT members on the first version. We tried to address most, if not all, of those comments. A couple things that I'll just mention that we did do. We added in a figure. There's a new figure called Figure 1A and B, which is a bar chart that just shows the amount of each major habitat type in existing MPAs. It kind of summarizes the gap analysis. We also added in more information from the scientific literature from studies that have been done in Central Coast MPAs. So the narratives of each MPA are a little bit more complete than they were. And then finally, we added in more discussion and habitat calculations for the PFMC no trawl zones, Vandenberg Security Zone 4, and the fixed RCAs. So, again, just additional information on these other types of closure areas, and those data are summarized in Appendix 3. So, you know, again, this is just a reference that will help in thinking about any potential changes to existing MPAs. It definitely is something that we should be referring to throughout our discussion of these packages, just to remind you all that, you know, all of the packages have to address the existing MPAs somehow and make some recommendations on each existing MPA. So this is the main reference for that.
Thanks, Mary. What we'd like to do next is to hear from Kirk Sturm. There's been some discussion and dialogue with the sister agency, the Department of Parks and Recreation. And Kirk, can you fill us in on this? Are you live?
Yes, I am alive. The microphone wasn't. Two California State Park updates, please. First, for Marla and the South Work Session participants, I have received the access and protection information you requested, including a color map for the new 18 miles of Hearst acquisition. Second, for all regional stakeholders, you are receiving from Melissa right now a copy of a document that was sent to the MLPA I-team from the California State Parks. This document identifies waters adjacent to existing land-based state parks that could be some sort of park, marine managed area, or underwater park. A couple of caveats, though. This document should be considered as informational only. This document is not directive nor a call to action to place, remove, or expand MPAs adjacent to any California state park. This document is not an MPA proposal, and it's not suggesting or requiring a specific type of MLPA zoning like state marine reserve or state marine conservation area. And finally, this document serves as a reminder that the California State Park Commission must work in conjunction with the Department of Fish and Game Commission to establish marine protected areas. And I invite you to meet with me offline to discuss either of these two California State Park updates. Thank you.
Thank you, Kirk.
Scott?
Yes.
Would this be the right time to ask clarifications on some of this interpretation?
If you can pose a question briefly, please go ahead. And if it becomes more lengthy, then we'll probably invite you to go ahead offline. But if you have a question,
yes,
please go ahead.
Yes, this was a question that was addressed at the hotspot meetings. I'm not sure if it was October 20th or November 2nd, but it continues to be a question which I don't know if we received a response or not. In the creation or the extension of an MPA that surrounds a terrestrial park, do the existing regulations that affect that marine reserve extend to the expansion of that marine reserve?
Thank you, Jesus. John Ugaritz, can you provide some insight on this?
Maybe. I'm confused a little by the question.
Let me rephrase it in my common street language. If we expand Point Lobos, is the day after the opening, are we going to see a kiosk at Monastery Beach?
Oh, well, no, you would not be expanding the state park holdings at Point Lobos by changing the state marine reserve boundaries or designation. The state marine reserve boundaries and designation are formed by the Fish and Game Commission, and though we do coordinate strongly with state parks at Point Lobos, that doesn't necessarily deal with their land holdings in any way. It would not create a new state park in anywhere outside the current state park boundaries at Lobos.
Thank you. So let's continue with our updates. Dave Edlin, do you have yet another? Good. Thank you. One of the issues that also has arisen is concerns the intersection between this effort and protection around military areas. And John Curlin wants to comment briefly on candidate MPA concepts in military areas.
You should have all received from me a couple of days ago an email with a memo attached providing some guidance about how to handle these areas of policy conflict. I'll be happy to answer any questions offline about more context, but the essential message is this decision will eventually be resolved, or any potential conflict will be resolved elsewhere, not in this group. And so our recommendation is that we proceed with the work of the stakeholder group in the design of MPAs, including possible candidates in these waters at this time.
Thanks, John. Another important update is the work of the EcoTrust research, and John Curlin wants to, again, kind of establish some expectations for this, and Mike Mertens is here to give us a brief update and presentation on their research.
Thank you. This is one of the efforts we started some time ago to bring in some of the information about socioeconomic impacts, and this information you're going to see now will be on commercial fisheries. We have available in the DF, Department of Fish and Game, data, some information on recreational fisheries, and most importantly, we have the perspectives and experiences of the stakeholders in this room of socioeconomic impacts. I wanted to say just a couple of things because about maps that are going to be put up, which are summary maps, and I want to, as Mike Mertens gives his presentation, these will be put up on. And they are useful, but I want you to look at them with a couple cautions. And the first caution is you can't get a good understanding of what we're trying to explain here from any single map. And the second point is that there is a lot of contextual information that is important, and so I urge you as you're looking at these maps and trying to think about them, and what they mean, to ask questions of Mike Mertens while he's here, and also particularly to ask questions of your colleagues who are commercial fishermen, because they have some understanding of what's behind the maps. They are summaries of many fisheries, and that's part of their value, but it is also leads to some necessity to understand the context, and they show a particular time period, and it's worth understanding the experience of fishermen in other time periods. So that's some of the contextual information would be valuable. There's enough richness in this that we could spend a lot of time in the group talking about it, and I'm going to ask that we not do that. But after Mike finishes his presentation, if there are questions, you deal with them sort of in individual conversations, and we'll sort of take a temperature check tomorrow, and if there's substantial uncertainty about what these means or further questions, then I'll find a way to get that addressed. But there's this valuable information now coming in addition to what you'll see on the maps. It's available in the GIS layers, and it'll be coming up. So that's a context for Mike Burton's presentation.
Thank you, John. So with that, we'd like to invite Mike to find a microphone.
I've got one right here.
Okay,
should I move to the front, or is this okay?
Why don't you stand up or move to the front so everyone can at least stand up so people can see you. That should be fine. Thanks very much.
Okay. I'll be as brief as possible here. I understand everybody has a lot of hard work to go through, but this information is very pertinent for the work that you'll be doing, obviously. The reason for doing this project, just a real brief background, is because other than the logbook data, the recordings that we have for commercial fisheries are really insufficient for capturing at least spatially explicit information about where commercial fishing is occurring. Where is the computer I'm pointing at? Oh, there we go. You can think of our project in three conceptual components: data collection, the processing, and then the summary. I'm really going to skirt over the first two here today, spend most of my time talking about the summary, just because that's the data that you'll be seeing, the maps that John referred to, and the that we'll be putting up on the walls, as well as the data that's going to be in the system. Data collection, many of you may have heard this before. Essentially, we wanted to interview as many fishermen as possible. And the idea is to get the fishermen to identify what's important to them. Obviously, it's impossible to interview all of the fishermen, so we had essentially a target. Hello? We were looking for those fishermen that were essentially the highliners, those people who were catching the most landings for any given fishery. We had some criteria that we were shooting for. We were looking to capture at least 50% of the total landings between 2003 and 2004 and at least five fishermen per fishery. So where we're at, we've interviewed 117 fishermen of 19 different fisheries categorized into the different regions. And this table right here represents essentially how close we came to our sampling criteria. The important columns here are the third column. You can see the number of fishermen sampled for each fishery. And the fourth column represents the proportion of the pounds that were caught by those fishermen. So if you look at the first row, we have nearshore rockfish. We sampled, interviewed 24 fishermen, and those 24 fishermen represented 38% of the total landings for that fishery.
Mike, I need to interrupt just very briefly for a program note. The owner of a gray Toyota, 2UGB660, has left his or her lights on. Sorry, go ahead.
That's quite okay. So what we ask in the interviews, essentially what we wanted to know was where people were fishing. That's kind of the most important thing. The next thing we asked was how much of those individual grounds that they've identified are they worth in terms of just kind of not necessarily in terms of a dollar amount, but we essentially gave the fishermen a hypothetical sack of pennies, 100 pennies, and said, distribute these amongst the shapes that you've identified. We also asked some supplemental information that was useful for doing back-end processing. We conducted the interviews using this nifty interface. This is an ArcView custom-built GIS interface that allowed us to collect the information on the fly digitally, so there wasn't a lot of back-end interpretation. As soon as we collected all the information, we got it back in-house in Portland, started to analyze it, started to compile it. So what we have here this is sensitive information we're talking about here. So this is a hypothetical fishery, one that I made up. It might actually exist. I'm not sure. They do eat some odd foods in Portugal. I was actually there this summer, so I don't remember seeing seahorse. But essentially what we do is we take everybody's shapes, overlay them into one data set, and then we start to add them up. And if you remember, we talked about the 100 pennies. those 100 pennies, each a penny that's been allocated to any given area gets added up for each fisherman. We're still dealing with one fishery here. The last step in the process is to aggregate it to some management unit. In the case of California, we're aggregating it to the CDFNG micro blocks. So we add up all of those values for any given unit. So this is where I want to spend just the bulk of my time, which is probably about three minutes. What I just showed was for one fishery. We actually do this for all of the fisheries. So here's another hypothetical fishery. Once we've done it for all of the fisheries, in Portugal there are three fisheries, we can start to derive some summary analysis with it. This is where you really begin to see the benefit of aggregating the information to the block level, because those micro blocks now hold a piece of information about each fishery, and we can literally do the overlay, put your perspective into kind of three-dimensional space here. That's an overlay of three fisheries, and start to look at some summary results. I met with a group of fishermen this morning. As John mentioned, we have some maps that we're going to put on the walls as soon as I'm done here. And we went over those maps. And the interesting thing I think John was alluding to is that the map, you can, when you start the map summary information, you can start, it really, what you're displaying really becomes kind of dependent on who's displaying it. And you can start to interpret it in a lot of different ways. So there are some pretty serious caveats when we show these maps. And you have to look at the whole picture. Any given map itself does not describe the whole picture of the fishing grounds. So these are just some of the types of summary analyses that we can look at. Of these, the top four are the ones that we've agreed to show, the fishermen agreed to show today. And use in your deliberations. So the first two are really just based on our sample. Number of fisheries that utilize any given management unit, number of fishermen interviewed that have specified any given management unit as being important. That is the number of fishermen that we interviewed, or that is the number of fisheries of the people that we interviewed. Just real quickly, looking at the first one, we can think of that three-dimensional overlay of the three maps. And we have here three fisheries. We add them up, go back to two-dimensional space, and what we have then is a count of the number of fisheries that are occurring in any given place. The pink here represents that at least one fishery identified a location. The magenta represents two fisheries identified the location, and the dark purple represents that all three of those fisheries actually identified a location as being important. Number of fishermen, it's very similar type of analysis, except we're taking the specific fishermen that we interview. The interesting thing about this is it can be biased in the fact that we didn't interview all of the fishermen, and we only interviewed fishermen on the Central Coast. We didn't interview fishermen from Santa Barbara who are coming up and fishing on this, in the Central Coast region. There's two associated with this bullet, which is the relative importance. And it really assumes that our sample size was sufficient. So in this case, it's actually biased when we're dealing with fisheries that are of smaller sample size. They tend to influence what's relatively important more than the other fisheries. But what we've done here is we've weighted each individual fishery based on an average economic value over a three-year period for the whole fishery. And those, let me see if I have... Yes, so remember back to the slide where we talked about the aggregates. This is actually a classification of values that actually exist within these individual blocks. Well, those values within the blocks represent a proportion that particular block is worth relative to the entire fishery, if that makes any sense. It's a little confusing, I understand. But what we do then is we apply the economic value averaged over a three-year period to that proportion and get a true value for each fishery for each block. We can then add up all of the fisheries together and look at our relative importance for the entire fishing grounds. So those are the maps. Whoops, those are the maps you're going to see. I flashed by that last slide very quickly because maybe I don't want people to contact me. But I'll be here. I'll be here throughout the day, I believe, depending on when I can get a ride back to San Luis. So feel free to ask me any questions. And again, like John said, be sure to, we discussed this in depth with the fishermen this morning, be sure to ask them questions as well, too. Thank you.
Thanks, Mike. John Curlin, you had tried to create some sideboards on this presentation and discussion. We have 7 minutes left. What kinds of questions would you productively like to entertain in the next 7 minutes? Mike? Microphone.
I think we ought to see if there are any questions. These data are important and subtle and open to not question about their validity, but question about what they mean and how they're constructed and how they should be best interpreted. But I've seen, and we should get the maps up, and then maybe people have. I think the best thing to do actually is to have conversations on the side, and then return to this and make certain that there, if there are any big questions, we get those identified tomorrow.
Okay. That being said, are there any clarifying questions right now, based on what Mike has presented or what John Curlin has advised? Yes, Caitlin.
Are we going to be given copies of the maps, or we're just going to be shown the maps? How are we going to get access to this information to sort of pore over it, understanding that there may be qualifications we may need to keep in mind?
Right. How will the RSG members interact with the data produced?
The maps are going to be put on the wall, and we haven't determined how they're going to be handed out as any hard copies. They are in the GIS layers, which means that any, as you're working with some of the, one of the technicians at a workstation, you can ask for them to be pulled up. And there are other ways to portray the data also at that point. But I don't know how we're going to handle publishing them, if you will.
So
they will be available on the wall today.
Lynn's question is, you can scan the maps, you can access the GIS layers while we're working over the next 2 days, and whether they're distributed or not is still an open question. Is that correct?
That's correct, and I just don't want to misspeak myself and create an expectation that we're not going to be able to deliver on. We just literally are getting these data into our system, and we're figuring out ways to provide access and maintain the confidentiality, et cetera.
Thanks. I have Howard and Rick.
You mentioned the GIS layers. Are the GIS layers in the public tools available to us?
That is my question. They're not in the public tools. And so, again, I have to work with the technicians here, who are the only ones who have them right now. That's exactly what we're trying to figure out, what will be available in public tools.
Okay. So I have Rick, Caitlin, and Tom. Rick.
Yeah, good morning. In this morning, thank you very much for the opportunity for some of the fishermen to preview the maps. A lot of the folks that were interviewed and pretty familiar with the process were having, myself included, having a hard time understanding what they meant and how to interpret them. And there was concern about facile interpretation of what these maps might mean. And so I would wonder if maybe after you put them on the wall, just a suggestion off the top of my head, that perhaps 10 minutes or 15 minutes for a discussion, possibly by one of the people that was involved in the survey, on how that was done with their fishery. I found it very helpful in understanding the map myself. For example, David Crabb led a very good discussion, or presented his fishery and how it related, and I found that very helpful.
So, Rick, just to be clear, you would suggest that we find a block of time to have this kind of interaction sometime over the next couple of days?
Micro block.
Okay. All right. Micro block of time. Very good. Caitlin, you had a further question?
Yeah, I would just ask that we do try to figure out a way for RSG members to get access to this information, even if it, you know, involves qualifications or comments from the fishermen who have concerns. You know, if that needs to be packaged together, I think that's fine. But I think this would be useful information for us to have access to. And if it becomes public on the decision support tool, I would ask that we also get hard copies of the maps, because my fear there is the folks who are comfortable using the tool will then have access to the information, and others who are not as technologically adept will not.
Thank you. Tom.
And everybody needs to remember the survey was done in the last 3 years. So that's when, after all the regulations have been in place, the last 3 years. So that will show that there's not a lot of areas being fished anymore than there was in the past. Kind, you know, you'd have to make that. Would you follow me there?
Mm-hmm. Good points. So, John Curlin, I'm hearing a lot of interest in trying to bring more clarity to this. And Marla, you had a comment as well.
I just wanted to thank EcoTrust and all the fishermen who participated. Thanks. I think that this really adds to everyone's understanding of what's going on, and it's a great, great thing to pull together. Thanks.
Thank you. Any other brief comments at this point? Yes. Holly.
I wanted to echo Rick's suggestion that I think there would be value in setting aside a small block of time to actually jointly look at this data. I'm just concerned if it gets fragmented into a variety of little discussions, we'll neither really understand what was being presented or the caveats that go with it. It seems like an important data set that we ought to spend some time on. Maybe it's 15 minutes, but...
Points well taken. Our sense is that there is some potential flexibility in the agenda over the next day and a half or so, and obviously we as an I-team have not conferred about where such a discussion might best fit, but we've heard you loud and clear that there's a request to do that, so we need to have that conversation. I also wanted to thank Mike for making the trip here on, I think, somewhat short notice, and appreciate very much your concise presentation, so thank you. What we'd like to do now is to do an overview of the flow of work for the four modules that the I-team has designed to really support the discussion of candidate MPA packages. And as we said, are we in the right place here, Eric? As we said, we had put aside... We had established four modules. These are all in support of the main goals of the meeting, which are to provide opportunities for groups of RSG members to present the packages that they've worked on and then to entertain discussion around that, to create opportunities, multiple opportunities for caucusing both within and across interest groups, to take stock in a useful way of the evolving support for these packages, and then to outline a report back to the Blue Ribbon Task Force. So the four modules are in support of those objectives. The first one is a series of presentations and discussion of candidate MPA packages, then caucusing, then presentation of revised packages, and then recapping progress. So the first module begins later this morning and runs until 5 p.m., Here, what we would like to do is invite presenters to come forward with brief summaries of packages. Now, in order to tee this up, initiative staff is going to present brief summaries of external MPA proposals and initial candidate MPA packages, just kind of to characterize the array of packages that have been developed. Turning to those developed within the CCRSG, stakeholder groups will present their initial candidate packages, and we really used three tests here to figure out which ones to agendize, and this relates to a question that Steve asked earlier in the morning. One is that the package covers the full Central Coast study area. The second is that the package was developed by multiple stakeholder groups, or presentation of it was requested by multiple stakeholder groups. And third, that the proposers in fact met the internal deadline that was established to request presenting these packages. So those were the decision rules that we used to sort of structure the flow of these presentations. Once the presentation is made, we're going to ask you first to really think about clarifying questions that would help you better understand the intent of the package and the content. And then we want you to begin brainstorming strengths and weaknesses. And during this part of the conversation, we'll try to ask specifically which goals and objectives and design considerations are not being met by a candidate package, and how could those packages be modified to better be consistent with the policy framework that you work together to establish. So those will be the main points of Module 1. Module 2 begins at 5 p.m. today, continues through the evening and into mid-morning tomorrow. The objectives there are to consider possible revisions to the packages and perhaps new candidate packages. The steps there on day one this afternoon, we want to ask you as a group to assess your interest, potential interest in developing new packages that build on some of the group MPA concepts that came out of the North-South work sessions. Just to add a note of detail there, there were a number of MPA concepts that seem to have broad-based support, but which are not now embedded in any of the packages that are going to be presented today. So they are building blocks, perhaps, of a new integrative package or packages, and we want to take stock of interest in working on those. In the evening, caucus during and after the group dinner, a focus on development of new candidate MPA packages as well as revision of initial candidate packages. So conversation will continue. GIS support can be arranged in much the same way as it was for the work sessions over the last 2 weeks. And then on day two morning, we want to come back here into the main plenary room and use this as a place to develop new candidate packages. We have two other locations identified, supported by workstations and GIS experts, to support the revision of the candidate packages that you'll hear about today. So at that point in time, we're really supporting work on two tracks, if you will. We'll then present, come back in Module 3, and that begins tomorrow mid-morning. Present and discuss the revised or new candidate packages and go through the same process as we will today. Namely, groups will present their package, we'll invite clarifying questions, and then we'll start to comment and begin to evaluate these different packages. We'll take a break tomorrow afternoon. The I-team will caucus. We will compose a straw ballot, and we will consider using different formats for gauging relative levels of support for these packages. And then we will go ahead with the straw vote tomorrow afternoon. And then finally, at the end of the day tomorrow, we'll recap progress and plan next steps. So that's basically the flow. And I think we should stop and not do the next ones. I think that's enough. Oh, okay. Eric points out there are a couple of other important process notes that we want to turn to. Eric, why don't you carry on the rest?
Thanks, Scott. Just to get the even bigger picture of the workflow over the next month plus, there is a SAT, a Science Advisory Team, meeting taking place on the 15th, and they will review the candidate MPA packages that are developed at this meeting and provide scientific input. On November 29th and 30th, the Blue Ribbon Task Force is meeting, and they will review and provide guidance as well on the candidate packages coming out of this meeting. Our next meeting will be December 6th and 7th in Monterey, and part of your job then will be to consider the guidance of the SAT and the BRTF and deliberate on a final set of alternative packages of MPAs. The next BRTF meeting then is January 31st and February 1st, and they will then review this final set of regional stakeholder group alternative MPA packages. Just a couple follow-ups on the process guidelines for this, I guess for this meeting and to help you think through how can we best work together. We want to encourage you to think that the packages we're talking about today are still works in progress, and as Scott mentioned earlier, we do expect them to change. We want you to recognize that this early development of MPA packages is conceptual and should not be represented outside of the group as proposals at this point. We especially encourage the development of packages by groups composed of multiple interests. And I think this is something that started to happen over the past month, where in the October meeting we had a lot of individual MPA concepts forwarded by particular individuals, and over the past month we really have seen a convergence of multiple groups, interest groups coming together and putting forward packages, and we really want to encourage the continuation of that process. As well, groups presenting candidate packages will have the opportunity to present them and discuss them without interruption in the spirit of inventing without committing, and this is, again, a continuation of our work during the work sessions. a couple other process guidelines. We'll be taking questions and evaluative comments after their presentations. So when they're made, we think it'll be most efficient to let the full presentation take place and hold your questions until the end. And again, we're asking you to make these comments in the spirit of respectful interaction, collaborative problem solving, and mutual gains. And while we're in the plenary, getting back to one final ground rule, in the work session, we had our particular rule that in any particular work session, if the primary was there, that the alternate would not participate and would have to communicate to the primary. As we've done in the past, in the plenary setting, if alternates do have a question, they can raise their card and we'll take those questions or comments as we've done in the past. Furthermore, when we're doing the caucusing, alternates are invited to participate fully. Okay, final slide on process approach. There were a lot of questions. Or John Curlin, do you have a quick comment?
I just had a comment question about the straw votes that were anticipated tomorrow being effectively for the guidance of this group, and the anticipation was not that they would not be reported to the BRTF. So we're basically trying to create an expectation of sense of this group.
Yeah, I think that's a very good point. You may recall that when we had our robust deliberation about goals and objectives, there was a bit of a debate about whether we should appropriately report numerical results of straw votes to the Blue Ribbon Task Force, and if so, in what form. I'm sure some of you may remember that conversation. It is our I-team advice and conclusion that this time around, when we take the straw votes, we will certainly report all of the results to you for your use, but it is not our intent to convey numerical results to the Blue Ribbon Task Force at the next meeting. What that means, though, is that we need to find an appropriate way to characterize the nature of the discussion, and we will, in fact, devote some time tomorrow afternoon to outline that presentation. And I'm sure John Curlin will have some sage advice at that moment in time. I do expect, just looking forward to December, that at that point in time, we will be driving to the conclusions of the RSG's recommendations to the Blue Ribbon Task Force. At that point in time, it may be appropriate to be more explicit about the relative level of support for the packages, because by then they will be more or less final with respect at least to this advisory process. And we'll want to make the clearest presentation we possibly can to the Blue Ribbon Task Force. That is a detail that, frankly, the I-team has not really even discussed yet. But just kind of looking around the corner, I think that's where we're going. Is that where you wanted to go? Okay. A couple of comments, I believe. Did you get all the way through this? I would actually suggest we finish this and then take your questions, because we just there's one more piece on the table, and that is how are we handling external proposals, and this fits into the conversation. So let's take a look at that. We established a deadline for submittal of external proposals by October 15th, and that was consistent with the guidance in the master plan framework. The I-team staff has reviewed all of the external proposals and will share with you a characterization of the sufficiency of these proposals relative to the guidelines. In other words, the question that we asked was, is this in fact a valid proposal? Does it meet all the tests? The proposals will be provided to the regional stakeholder group. The regional stakeholder group is invited to introduce an entire proposal, external proposal, or elements of an external proposal into these deliberations. External MPA proposals that do cover the entire study area will be referred to the SAT for evaluation, and the Blue Ribbon Task Force will be provided with descriptions, evaluations, and RSG actions regarding those external proposals. Much of that commentary may start in the next 2 days. Probably more of it will ensue over the December meeting, I would imagine. Okay, so with that, let's see if there are questions or clarifications needed. I see Steve and Rick.
First, a suggestion for
really all the voting that we might do, that we make use of a paper ballot. And secondly, a question, I guess maybe for Chairman Phil, just what will the discussion at the Blumen Task Force be like? On what basis are they going to evaluate or provide feedback for the stuff that we bring to them?
Stephen, you mean in particular at the November meeting of the Blue Ribbon Task Force? Chairman Phil.
Will be brilliant, insightful, direct, and obscure. I mean, I don't know. Our question to the staff is, well, what are they all doing? You know, what are they up to? What are you guys up to? What do you do? And I know at some point, it may not be later this month at our meeting, but in January, we're going to have something organized for us. Is how many, I know we're using the word array, but forget the terminology, how many project area proposals are out there? I mean, we can handle a certain number. I don't want to put a number on it, but you know, we've already requested options and alternatives. And you know, if you said, well, how many should we present? And I'd say, well, enough. And you say, how many is that? Well, I don't know. But if you came in with 75 alternatives, we'd probably suggest execution. If you came in with just one, we'd be astonished. And I don't know how we'd respond to that. But, I mean, try to, whatever it is you do, we're going to have all of your deliberations, unfortunately, structured and categorized in order for us to have even a chance of understanding what you're recommending. And so I know that doesn't exactly answer your question.
Actually, what Chairman Phil said is he's counting on the I-team staff to make sense of the deliberations and present them in an understandable way.
Or of the regional stakeholder group taking the I-team instructions and then making it understandable. Either way. We don't care who makes it understandable as long as somebody does.
Right. Thanks. Rick.
Thank you. I'd like to just say I think what we should try to do is get the Blue Ribbon Task Force our top three proposals to do our job and help them out. But that's off subject, more relating to Phil's comments. You answered one of my big questions with the external, how are you going to handle the external process? Thank you very much. And I guess maybe this is a time to say that thank you very much for that summary. I think you did a really good job of telling us where you're going. You answered all my questions except for one I'll bring up at the end. And you're doing a good job of bringing order to chaos as best we can. I've cursed you many times because of the workload, but I know you're working twice as hard, so I'll take this as a compliment and thank you for that summary. The question I had that came up during your presentation, and I probably misunderstood, but about a third of the way through, Scott, I think you said that there was other proposals that appeared to have cross-broad interest support that we had not seen yet or not embedded in the material yet, or did I misunderstand, or what?
No, I didn't say that. What I said was that during the North-South team work sessions, individual MPA concepts were vetted, which appeared to have greater support than one stakeholder, two or more. Some of those individual MPA concepts are not yet embedded in the packages that are being presented. That's what I said. So they're not by any means full-blown packages. They're individual MPA concepts that had some level of cross-interest group support.
So if those bloom into full-blown flowers of networks, we will be probably presented with those, or if they die before blooming, we won't see them?
Right, but we're hoping to provide some nutrients this afternoon and tomorrow. They're all organic, of course. But
You're tending those.
Yeah, right.
All right, thank you.
Okay. John Ugaretz.
Yeah, I just wanted to take a little time before we get into the presentations and the caucusing today to remind you all of a couple things. You've been working very well together over the last month and across interests, and I'm really very impressed with all of the work that's gone on. There is a distinct possibility at this point in a process like this that people will fall back on their positions, as opposed to continuing to actually caucus and think about their interests. And And just briefly to explain how that differs, if you were out buying a car, your position might be that you are willing to spend $5,000, and darn it, that's what you're going to spend. That doesn't describe your interest. Your interest might be that you want power windows and doors, and you don't want red paint, and you don't want a leather interior. And if you were discussing that with a car salesman, you might come to agreement that you're willing to accept red paint as long as you actually get a sunroof as well. And so what I'm trying to describe here is that at this point in the game, try not to fall back on, well, darn it, I just can't accept that. Try and explain what your interest is. And the way that will help us in the long run is when you don't reach agreement, which you likely won't reach full agreement as a whole group on anything, you will be able to describe to us and the task force what are your interests and what interests were met and not met in any proposal, whether it's yours or someone else's. And again, I think they brought that up in the presentation, that what we're asking you to do here is focus on what objectives are being met, what objectives are not being met from your perspective. And you may disagree on that. But again, just really reiterating that over the next day and a half, you have a lot of time available to talk about different groups' proposals and come to some levels of understanding about those and sharing interests.
Thanks, John. Very good advice to focus on interests as well as positions. Rick, did you have a further clarification? You're all clarified. Rick, and by the way, thank you very much for your kind words. That's appreciated. What we'd like to do now is to turn to our Module 1, the presentation and discussion of candidate packages. And one of the opportunities that we made available to members of the regional stakeholder group was to ask to request that the initial draft concept proposal be considered and evaluated. And Don Canestro has made that request and is prepared to... Mary?
Me first.
Sorry. Oh. Melissa and Mary have pointed out that I've forgotten an introductory piece. Mary Gleason, would you like to set the stage for this presentation, please?
Sure.
Thank you.
Okay, Don's going to follow me, but I'm basically just going to give a summary of the external proposals that we've received. The initial draft concepts from the last MLPA go-around in 2001 were kind of viewed as part of the external packages because they didn't come from this group, but Don has asked them to be considered, so he's going to give a presentation on those. So they might, you know, migrate from the external to the internal or some portion of them. But basically, I'm just going to give you a brief summary of the external proposals. You should look at your handout number 3, which is called Central Coast MPA Proposals Received from Sources External to the CCRSG. And again, these are things that came in by the October 15th deadline. All of the entire proposals can be found on the website if you want to see everything that the proponent provided. And just to kind of, let's just walk through this handout real quickly, and then I'll just go through a brief summary of each one. But basically, we've provided a summary table, and we've divided up the external proposals into those that seem to address complete arrays or the entire study region, and those that are more just about one or two individual MPA concepts. So we've identified the proposer, the date received, the geographic extent. We've provided a summary that comes actually from the proposal itself. It's text from the proponent. And then a brief summary of the number and type of MPAs that they're proposing in their array. And so if you flip through that, you'll see we've got one from NRDC, one from Oceana, and one, you know, one from Don Canestro and Marla requesting a review of the initial and revised draft concepts. And after that, you'll see a colored matrix. This is on page 6, where we've then gone through and done some sort of initial staff evaluation of these proposals and just really tried to answer some basic questions about the proposals and whether they met the requirements of Appendix F. Because, again, these external proponents are being asked to put together complete proposals, and so they're going to have to structure them to meet the requirements in Appendix F. So, you know, we've just listed a variety of criteria that we use to do this initial evaluation. Is it a complete array? Did they explain their information sources and who participated?
Do they discuss how their proposal relates to existing MPAs? Do they explain the relation of their proposal to the goals and objectives of the stakeholder group? So a variety of criteria, and we've just sort of gone through and done a brief evaluation. And then if you keep flipping through, you'll see that there's we start another table of proposals that basically are for individual MPAs or groups of MPAs, and do, again, an evaluation of those. So I'm just going to go through and spend a couple minutes on each of these six external proposals. We don't have hard copy maps on the wall, but we do have these, you know, in the GIS, so if you want to look at any of these more closely, we can pull them up and look at them. But I'll just give you a sort of a brief overview. So basically the first one is from NRDC, and this is the north half. Paula is just going to kind of span through it. They've identified 22 MPAs, 15 reserves, 3 parks, and 4 conservation areas. It's about 250 square miles that they claim covers representative habitats in both shallow and deep waters, and addresses goals 1 through 4 of the MLPA, according to the proponents. You know, one issue with this proposal is it doesn't really address what to do with all of the existing state MPAs, and that's actually an issue with all of the external proposals, and as well as the internal arrays that we'll be talking about later. It's very important that each of the existing state MPAs be addressed in some fashion. So if, you know, basically some of them are just sort of missing from this list, so it's not clear if the proponent is suggesting they be removed from the system or just included as they are. So basically each existing MPA needs to be addressed in some fashion in terms of modifications or removal or no change. So that's actually a problem with all of these external proposals. But again, this is one. We have all the shapes. You know, we can look at them more closely. If people are interested in going through it in more detail, we can do that at any time. So let's just pull up the next one, which is from Oceana. Again, this is another proposal that covers the entire study region. It's a little hard to see on the screen here, but what they've done is they've identified 12 areas of what they call ecological importance. They've divided those into subregions and then sort of categorized or ranked them by their relative importance for different objectives that they developed. So they did not actually specify types of MPAs in each of these areas. So this proposal lacks any MPA designation. It's really just guiding information on areas of importance. It doesn't say what should be done in these areas. There's very little discussion of allowable uses or type of MPAs that should be established. Again, it does not address what should be done with existing state MPAs. But there is a lot of useful information in here in terms of the habitat layers and other ecological data layers that they pulled together and looked at to identify these areas. So I think there's, you know, some good background information that you might find useful. This proposal also does not really relate these areas to specific stakeholder goals and objectives for the region. So that's something, again, that link is not really there. But again, useful information. We can pull up the maps and look at them at any point if you'd like to. And then moving on, the next one that we view as sort of a complete array proposal is initially was a request from Don Canestro to look at the initial draft concept from the 2001 MLPA effort. That was sort of amended and added to by Marla, who actually requested we also look at how those were revised. So there's both initial and revised draft concepts. Don's going to give a presentation of those. I don't know if you can zoom in a little bit on the map. Initial and revised. Yeah. But basically, the initial draft concept identified 22 MPAs, 189 square miles, about 22% of state waters in the study region, which extended just to Año Nuevo. The revised concept reduced that area by about 60%, down to 21 MPAs that were smaller, 75 square miles, and about 8.6% of the study area.
I'm sorry, I don't have that data ready. I was just
okay.
Ready,
so it's not Well, Paul, we can pull the map up when actually Don is going to do a presentation on this, so we'll sort of come back to this one and talk about it at more, so you have time to do that. Okay, the next proposal I wanted to talk about was from HOPE, the Helping Our Peninsula Environment Group. This one, we actually, in the summary form, we had categorized it as a proposal that just addressed individual or a couple MPAs, and there are actually only two MPAs they're proposing, but they're quite large, and so they actually, I think this proposal could be viewed as a complete array. Basically, you know, one of the MPAs proposed is a state marine reserve that covers the entire sea otter habitat, so it extends from throughout the whole study region out to 1 mile. Or 150 meters, whatever is greater. So it's a very large area, and therefore does, you know, would probably represent a complete array because it's the entire study region. This proposal again does not really address what to do with existing MPAs. It doesn't relate the proposal to the regional goals and objectives, but it should be sort of viewed, I think, more in terms of being a complete array rather than an individual concept. Then sort of a couple additional ones, so I think we'll move on to the PRBO ones. We got two proposals from Point Reyes Bird Observatory from different individuals. One is focused on Año Nuevo area only, so it's not a complete array. It's not addressing the entire study region. It identifies two MPA alternative concepts. Focused, you know, again on this Año Nuevo area, in large part focused on seabird and marine mammal protection, as well as just protecting the ecological values of that area. It doesn't really explain allowable uses or relate to the goals and objectives of the regional stakeholder group, but it does actually provide some interesting, important ecological information from seabird and marine mammal experts for that area. The next one, also from PRBO, is down in the Santa Maria Basin area. They've identified five MPAs in that area that they would like to propose. They kind of stripe the coast down around in the Santa Maria Basin. Again, this has a little bit more detail than the other PRBO proposal, but again, it doesn't relate exactly to the existing MPAs and the goals and objectives. It does a little bit in this region, but it's not a study region-wide array, so it doesn't address the rest of the region. And again, it's focused primarily on seabird and marine mammal protection, as well as other ecological values in that area. Again, there's some, you know, good ecological information embedded in that proposal about that area. So that represents the range of external proposals we've received. We've given these evaluations to those proponents and ask them to, you know, revise their proposal if they desire. I think the other issue is, you know, just for the stakeholders to recognize that they can look at all of these proposals, look at these maps, and use any portion of them that are useful to this process. And if you have any comments on this evaluation, we're happy to hear those as well. So I think I can take questions, and then I think the next step will be to turn it over to Don to talk more about the initial a draft concept.
So let's entertain perhaps two or three questions and then understand that further questions can be directed to Mary offline. Jesus. Okay.
Yes. Thank you, Scott. So if any stakeholder was interested in any of these arrays, outside arrays, what's the procedure for getting them included into the whole process, or are they included now after their amendments by November 14th?
Mike DeLappa, do you want to comment?
Well, they're included to the extent that the information is available to you. We've invited you to incorporate portions or all of them. Anybody here can try to seek support for those, and they can be put on the table. If later on we have some kind of evaluation process of those particular proposals, they'll certainly be carried through, you know, and be provided, the SAT will be provided an opportunity to comment on them if they meet the overall array concept in a way that can be evaluated by them. I mean, if they have the data that can be evaluated by them. And of course, they can also and will also be carried forward to the BRTF. So there's a lot of different ways they can move forward. I think this process really is focused on having the stakeholders work collaboratively to develop proposals, and we again invite you to take the portions of these that make the most sense, or the whole, if you decide to coalesce around a given one, to move that one forward.
The difficulty that I see here is that we're going to be doing some straw voting tomorrow, and these outside proposals have been given until November 14th to clarify issues that were left unanswered. For example, Oceana didn't say whether high priority meant that they wanted those areas to be a marine reserve and so on. And I understand NRDC is going to be making some alterations to theirs, which then might make it more acceptable or objectionable to some stakeholders. But if they don't have to do it until November 14th, how do we do the straw voting and incorporate these concepts if they're not really completely done? We don't have a clear idea as to what their proposal is.
Well, I mean, just like the proposals that you have are still evolving, these will be as well. And so certainly the ones, I mean, you could put any of these on the table. I mean, I would just say practically there is a challenge in terms that we're finding internally as far as staff being able to evaluate, you know, lots and lots of concepts. And so as we are prioritizing that in the way of saying, okay, we're trying to support first and foremost the ones that come out of this group, and also encourage this group to incorporate all those other ideas so we don't have so many individual packages that we have to then evaluate each one against, you know, 60 or 70 objectives or whatever.
You have stated that, or Phil Eisenberg stated he doesn't want 72 arrays, but I've heard that you are willing or have considered forwarding to the Blue Rim Task Force 4 or 5. That's the number that was thrown around. After the amendments, the stakeholders wish to give support, is there a way to, can we email the support and thereby maybe bring it in as one of the third, fourth, or fifth arrays that should be forwarded to the Blue Ribbon Task Force?
Well, again, I think in both at this meeting tomorrow and in December, as we decide to value proposals and this group decides to take that on, certainly the members here could bring forward any of those proposals and ask for some support. I would suggest that you know, that there needs to be some groundwork by people to build that support and to get people to understand those, and that may prove challenging when you're also trying to build support for other packages. So, you know, there's nothing that prevents you tomorrow or next week saying we want to have this one valued by this group and ask this group to value it, whatever that process is that we decide. I would just suggest that will take, I don't think it's just simply a matter of asking people to vote on it, because everybody has to become educated and has to understand what's in there and has to understand how it relates to the goals and objectives. And as Mary pointed out, a lot of that work hasn't been done, nor has it been related to the existing MPAs. So there's some pretty big gaps right now in those external proposals, and somebody, you know, the external submitters will be doing work on that.
Just one final.
If I could fold in, I think embedded in your question is something like, so which packages are going to be on the straw vote and which ones can we consider tomorrow? The I-Team's current thinking is that primary emphasis is to be given to those generated here at this table, or strongly endorsed and introduced by people here at this table. That does not mean that the external proposals can't be folded into a straw voting process at some later point in time, but very likely they will not be folded into the straw vote that we conduct in this meeting. So, and this is a moving target. That's our current thinking. And John Kerlin, if I've misstated that, please correct me. But I think you do raise a fair question. We've got these other tracks of proposals. How can you, as a regional stakeholder group, take account of them? The reality is they're not quite on the same time step as the work that you've been developing here. And we really want to give primacy to those proposals developed at this table jointly by the people who are in this dialogue.
One final clarifying question, and I'll close down. I know that the objective of the next 2 days is to reduce the number of options. ideally. But going on the assumption that you're willing to consider moving forward four or five options, let me give an example. If the Canestro plan, one that has already been evaluated and I'm assuming meets all the criteria from the scientific analysis from 2001, are we going to have the option of saying we want, on the straw voting, I guess, or however you guys decide to process this, to move forward two or three sets, or are you going to try and limit us to voting preferably to one?
Not one, for sure. I mean, we expect there will be an array that are, I mean, I don't want to prejudge what this looks like because we still have a day and a half of work to do, but we don't expect to an up or down vote on one package. We expect several to be on the table through this meeting. I hope I haven't made any misstatements, John Kerlin or John Ugaritz.
I would suggest that we not worry about this right now. We got a lot of work to do today.
That's fine advice.
I think there will be many options as to how to proceed tomorrow as well as how to proceed in December. Nothing is final from this group at the end of these 2 days. So we've got a lot of work ahead of us, and let's get to it.
Yeah, I agree. Does anyone else have a burning need to ask a clarifying question before we move on? Rick?
Can you just, Mary or Mike, can you tell me real quickly what where the Point Reyes bird suggestions are, especially in Santa Maria Basin, and more maybe if a RSG member wants to contact those folks, or so that we might see if we could incorporate it into a network, how is that information available, or do they get a hold of us? Or?
Yeah, I mean, the proposal is on the website. We can pull up the maps here and look at them. You know, so you can incorporate them if you want to. I don't know what else you need.
And I can give you the contact information.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Okay. I would ask the remaining folks to be very concise in their questions. Eric.
Question for John, with a comment along. I know, John, I think the zero option by law is part of the CERCLA, and maybe I don't have my terminology right, but the zero option has to go forward. At some point in this process, and I know since Jeremiah isn't here, in our meeting in Monterey where we broke up into the groups, he officially wanted to put forward, you know, the zero option as is, status quo. I don't see that, and I know it's not really an external proposal. I just want to see if that's still in the mix.
Yeah, the no project alternative.
Yeah, there's always a no project alternative that goes to the commission, and no project in this case would mean the existing MPAs as they stand. So that will go forward with some analysis of what it does and does not do.
Yeah, thanks, Eric. Good clarification. Marla?
Mary, can we get a copy of these maps? Could we print up the six that are available so we could have them with what you've given us?
Today?
If possible, yes.
It's going to be tough to do color copies today, but we can, you know, we have a lot of screens around the room. We can keep them up to look at.
Well, if possible. If we could get that summary map, it would be very helpful. I think even if it was in black and white, it would be fine.
Okay.
Bob?
Yeah, we could do black and white, I think.
Thanks.
Are you requesting that all the proposals contain all the criteria on this colored sheet? And if so, do you have guidelines on our requirement for explaining the social economic impacts or explaining the funding needs and sources?
just so we're clear, those are all the criteria that are identified in Appendix F. And for the ones that come out of the stakeholder group, the staff will be supporting the development of that information as it moves forward. So, you know, again, this is sort of incremental. You know, we have a certain set of information today, and as we begin to hone down on exactly what those are and where they are, we'll be able to develop more specific information about some of the enforcement issues. We're working on a separate tract on funding for all of these, so that is happening as well.
Thank you very much for your clarifying questions. Bob, did you have a further question, or you're all set? We recognize this process is intense, complicated, and fast-moving, and it is for the I-team, too. And as you can tell from the comments that Mike and Mary just made, we have to make lots of trade-offs in deploying our heroic staff resources, and we've tried, as we said, to really give the emphasis to the proposals that are developed around this table. And with that spirit, I would like to ask Don Canestro if he is now prepared to summarize this initial concept proposal.
And I'm not going to go through the whole package of the summary. You were given that the last meeting, I think, so you can read that, or hopefully you've read it and got questions. All I'm going to talk about is I want to ask you that this be moved forward for review by the SAT and the BRTF once I complete the purple boxes with Mary's help, I hope. I realize there's some inadequacies there. This proposal represents the best available science at the time it was developed and was specifically designed to meet the goals of the MLPA. It has also been peer-reviewed, and that's also available. The fact that it significantly overlaps with other proposals that will be put forth also reinforces its significance. It provides an alternative either as a whole network for the region, or specific sites or concepts could be used from within this proposal to complement other proposals, sort of pieces of the puzzle. A lot of time and effort of scientists and the department staff went into the development of this proposal to best meet the goals of the MLPA, and I don't want to see those wasted. And so eventually I'll ask for your support once I get a complete package together in moving this proposal forward. And that's basically it for my presentation.
Concise it was. Thank you very much. Okay. David Crabb.
Just a question about... I was noticing under the colored part, which was green, was the socioeconomic impacts, and without reading the proposal, I'm guilty of that. I'm wondering how the socioeconomics was addressed.
I'm sorry, you're talking about the initial draft concepts? That, I think, we'll have to refer to the department in terms of what was done in looking at socioeconomic impacts last time around. Paul or John?
I'll answer that, John.
As part of developing the initial draft concepts, the existing fisheries were considered as to where they're operating and or where they were operating, which was quite a bit different in 2000 than it is now, and how this may impact those areas. There was no formal economic analysis, nor as significant an effort in data collection as there has been in this process.
Thanks. Good question, David.
So just a quick follow-up. The green box doesn't necessarily mean it was a up-to-date or thorough job. It just means a job was done.
Apparently. Steve.
Question for Don about what you mean by that this proposal was peer-reviewed. And I guess I would suggest that might be a sort of a relative concept, because whatever scientific review done of it was done before the master plan framework guidelines were developed and also before we adopted our goals and objectives.
I agree with you totally. It was done before that, and I think it's great. I think it's actually, that's one of the exciting things, is to see this go through the master plan framework and the scientific criteria. So I'm actually think it deserves getting that type of review, so I'm looking forward to that.
Okay, any other quick questions of Don? Okay, so we are ahead of schedule. How interesting. How did that happen so quickly? It's happened from time to time. I'm stalling here because Mary's in caucus.
Scott, I don't know how far ahead of schedule we are, but it might be useful to start considering the proposal to look at the economic maps and have a little discussion, depending on how much time we have. I don't know if there's enough time.
Mary's up until noon? Okay.
Then we probably don't have enough time to do that.
Okay. Mary Gleason.
Me again? Okay.
You again.
Not ready. Okay. So basically, we have four internal array proposals, or sort of three and a half, actually. We have one from the fishermen, one from conservation-oriented stakeholder members, and two from diving interests. Their maps are on the wall. Behind me is the fisherman's proposal. In the corner is the conservation. And in that corner over there are the diver proposals. And, you know, each of these groups is going to do a presentation today. What I just wanted to offer is a way of an overview or an introduction is a couple of handouts. The first is handout number 2. If you look through your handouts, and I have to find mine too. But basically, for each of the proponents, we asked them to fill out what we called an MPA array form. It looks like this. It just really asks for some basic information from them on who are their proponents, what are the number and type of MPAs in their array, what's their rationale and any commentary, and then to list out each of the MPAs, what their allowed uses are, what their designation is, what goals and objectives they contribute towards. So it's just was a way to kind of force the initial proponents to start thinking about how the pieces of their array will contribute to the ultimate goal of meeting the goals and objectives. And so for each of these four array proponents, we have an MPA form that they filled out. In addition, if you look after that, behind that, there's a spreadsheet that for each of the arrays, the GIS staff did an analysis of habitat calculations and total area inside each type of MPA, SMR, SMPs, and SMCAs. So there's, again, this is quite a bit like the gap analysis that we did for the Central Coast region and the existing MPAs. It basically, you know, takes this array and, you know, tells us approximately, given the data quality issues, how much hard and soft substrate we've got, kelp forest, various other habitat types, what the total area is, and the percentage of the study region in each type of MPA. So, you know, while these proponents are doing their presentation, you might just look through some of this background material, and, you know, it will help you maybe, you know, identify some questions you have for them on representation and coverage and things like that. So that's, you know, the basic analysis that we did for each of these array proposals. And again, we have the maps on the wall. And I think that was it in terms of an overview.
Good. Thank you. Did you want to add something, Eric?
Yeah.
Marla's got a question, I think.
Marla.
Could we get black and white maps of the ones on the wall as well as the external? That would be about 10 maps, I guess. But I really think that it would be very useful to attach those to what
you've
given us.
The issue is just that, you know, the poster size maps, you can't do an 8.5 by 11 by that. I mean, you'd have to do 10 of them to capture, you know, what's on a poster size map. It's very hard to show the whole region on, you know, on one map. So, you know, we kind of opted to just go with, you know, the poster size wall copies and then the GIS.
Even though it would be small, I think it would still be, it's like the cheap graphic.
Right.
Even though you know you have to go to look at the bigger picture, it's still visual to help capture your table.
We can try.
Good. Any other questions or comments at this stage? Well, with that, my sense is that what we ought to do now is roll on and begin public comment. Our ground rule that we've established for public comment is that we ask speakers to limit their comments to 3 minutes. We also have adopted the convention of asking how many speakers we have and then seeing if we need to further allocate that time. So if you wish to make a public comment, would you please stand up so we can see you and count you?
Could I make a suggestion? You've got the public comment period at the beginning of this meeting, and not a lot to comment on right now because we haven't seen and heard what. Maybe a suggestion would be to have a public comment period
more towards day tomorrow where we can comment on some specifics.
Well, the suggestion is well taken. We definitely have considered this idea, sir, and we Our feeling is globally there are many pathways of public comment available into this process, including those external to the meeting. And rather than wait till the end of the meeting, we've chosen to front load the public comment period at this time and make it a predictable time. So I appreciate the logic of your comments, but I think we're going to stay with our existing plan, and also perhaps IT members can acquaint you with some of the other ways that you can make comments if you want to submit things for consideration after you hear the other presentations. So I do appreciate your thought. So we have six or seven. Looks like we've got just about enough time for the full 3 minutes. Let's go from left to right and begin the presentations. Jeff, do you want to kick it off?
Hi, everyone. My name is Jeff Schester, and I'm representing the Regional Marine Conservation Project in Oceana today. And I would like to commend the work that everyone has done so far. It's clear that there has been a tremendous amount of work, and we do have a difficult task ahead. But what's at stake is really the long-term viability of recreational fishing, commercial fishing, and our ocean ecosystems. And what we're here to do is try and help out and assist the stakeholder group as much as we can. That's why we submitted our proposal on October 15th. And what we did there is we basically did a comprehensive review of the available data and took a systematic scientific approach to figure out all the different ecological features that would be important for the top predators, the forage fish, the benthic species, and the habitat. And what we've done is identified areas and corresponding management objectives so far in our proposal to protect the specific ecological features that we've identified to meet the goals and objectives of the MLPA. And that's what we've done so far. And basically, we've been to all the working groups and taking excellent notes and talked with many of you, and we hope to talk to more of you as well, basically as we move forward here. And we're here to listen and discuss what we've done so far and the work that we've put together with all of you, and we're prepared to do that. And we're now also working with the I-team staff and with that matrix that they developed to figure out how we can develop a complete proposal that can be evaluated by the SAT and Blue Ribbon Task Force and this group as well by November 14th deadline. And that will include management measures, and we are going to make every attempt to fully complete the proposal as Mary Gleason has described. And basically, we're here to help, and we'd like to continue talking with everybody and hope that our information can be useful in this process to all of you. So thank you.
Thank you, Jeff. Who's our next speaker?
Could you stand, please?
So please indicate your name and affiliation if you could, please.
Yeah, my name is Phil Adams. I live here in Cambria. I'm here to speak specifically in support of the proposal for the Pedras Blancas site, including 3 miles of offshore protection. I'm a volunteer with the Pedras Blancas Lighthouse, helping with its restoration, and State Parks as a volunteer interpretive naturalist. I'm also a docent with Friends of the Elephant Seal and a past president of the board of that organization. And I also do a once-a-month survey of the beaches near Point Sierra, Nevada for the Monterey Bay National Marine Sanctuary. So I also find time to be a recreational fisherman. And needless to say, I spent a lot of time around the site for this proposed reserve, and I can tell you it's a perfect candidate for protection. In this small area of the coast, there are types of most of the different ecosystems we need to preserve. There are 2 points, Sierra Nevada and Pedras Blancas. There are rocky and sandy beaches, rocky and sandy nearshore areas, thick giant kelp and bull kelp beds, and large subsurface and subsurface rocks. This also, the site is easily identifiable boundaries from shore and at sea, and there will already be people in place at the lighthouse to do shore monitoring. 4 years ago, when I learned about the possibility of marine protected areas and was a member of the first Stakeholders Advisory Council, Pedras Blancas was the first place I thought of, and the one I felt most strongly about for protection.
Thank you very much. Go ahead.
My name is Darrell Terra, and I'd like to address some of the issues with primarily the near shore. I've been a fleet manager at Virgin Sport Fishing and commercial fish for the past 30 years also. One thing I'd like to keep in mind that the fuel costs for the fishermen, recreation, and sport has doubled basically in the last year, so you want to keep that in mind as far as the distance traveling to the fishing areas would not be as nearly available because of the fuel impact. And also, I saw one proposal for the primarily only recreational off Cambria, and I was kind of concerned about that because the way Fish and Game has it, that right now recreational can go from 30 fathoms into the shoreline, and commercial is 20 fathoms into the shoreline. And if you add up that 10 fathoms and go up the whole coast, that's hundreds of square miles where it's recreational already. So I'd like you to keep that in mind. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Who's our next speaker? Go ahead.
My name is Elizabeth Bettenhausen. I live here in Cambria. I grew up in North and South Dakota, where we went spoonbill catfish fishing in the Missouri River, and we took trips up into Manitoba for fishing of the northern pike. And I loved it and love fishing still, as the Morro Bay people perhaps know. I lived most of the last quarter of a century, though, in Boston, and when I read last September about your work, I said, what a great pity that you all didn't live in Boston and in the New England area about a quarter of a century ago. Many of the students I worked with in doctoral programs at Boston University worked with people in Gloucester, and how you have managed to balance competing interests in this group is simply laudable. So I congratulate you all for doing something that not many of us ordinary citizens often do. I also volunteer now in the grade school and bring shells from dead animals, of course, to the grade school to show them where they live and how the grade school kids can understand this marine area where often they don't even visit. But I got to thinking, after reading about the work that you're doing, what will these kids in second grade this year think about the marine area where they live in a quarter of a century from now? So the challenge that you have before you, you well know much better than I, but I ask you to think about what I see every week when I volunteer at Piedras Blancas. How will I show these little kids what it means to listen to a conversation of sea lions who are debating the possibility of eating much that surrounds them while I am pulling up ice plant? I don't know how to convey that kind of experience to you, but fortunately I can tell you all already know it. I would be delighted if an area around that lighthouse point could be as protected as Representative Lois Capps now wants to help protect the point itself. So I urge you to give considerations to how the kids who will be 25 years old in a quarter of a century or 50 will understand the quality of this whole area, both for fishing, as you are well doing, as well as conserving the natural resources. I thank you for the privilege of being able to attend this meeting here in Cambria. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Karen.
Karen Garrison, Natural Resources Defense Council, and thank you for that reminder that it is about future for all of us. NRDC, like Oceana, will be working to complete our proposal and trying to talk to many of you again for the... Oh, not working? Maybe closer. Okay. But I'm really here to just ask a question, probably of you, John Ugaretz, regarding the hotspots information, which seems to me to be a potential win-win because you're talking, I think, about identifying areas of current high catch for some of the species that are most at risk. And in return for that, I think the department will be going to the Pacific Fishery Management Council and asking for some of the rockfish conservation areas that may be less effective to be reopened. Do I understand that correctly? So my question for you really is that information available for people to use at this meeting, and is it available to use after this meeting for those of us who are trying to think about sites and trying to actually capture some of those hotspots? And is the department available for assisting people in interpreting it to make sure we use it correctly?
Yes, it's available for the stakeholder group at this meeting. Because it's draft, it will not be available after this meeting. We are in the process of finalizing it along with Pacific Fishery Management Council members and NOAA fisheries scientists. So until that time, it can't be publicly available.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any other public comments? Yes, sir. We need to get you a microphone.
My name is Ernie Kep, and I'm director of the Alliance of Communities for Sustainable Fisheries. I do a lot of work in the communities talking to commercial fishermen, and I've been a commercial fisherman all my life and still am. Some of the information that you're probably, a lot of you are aware of here, is that there have been a lot of regulations over the last 10 years that have actually curtailed the commercial fishing, and this group here is just yet another one, and they are already bearing fruit. There's evidenced by a resurgence in the populations of salmon, crab, sea lions, sardines up and down the coast. So this a lot of the protections that this group will be considering today and in this process have already been undertaken by other federal and state agencies and groups, and that just I would like you to bear in mind that the footprint of commercial fishing and recreational fishing by regulations over the last 10 years has been greatly reduced, and I would urge you to avoid the extremes. One extreme would be zero protection, and the other extreme would be much protection that I've seen on some of the maps. And I just want you to know that this work has already been undertaken. It has been going on for quite some time now and beginning to show positive results in the populations of species along our shores. Thanks.
Thank you very much. Do we have any other members of the public who would like to address the RSG? No? We will now assess whether lunch is ready. Thumbs up from Rita. All right, so what we'd like to do is capture this time that we have. Go ahead and launch your queuing up for lunch. We are planning in about 10 minutes' time to hear from Dr. Stephen Gaines on ecological networks of marine protected areas, and then we'll take stock and see if we might carve out some time for this review of the EcoTrust data that some have requested. So let us go ahead and get in line for lunch, and we'll be prepared to hear from Steve Gaines in about 10 minutes. Thanks very much.